Fear inflicted, danger instigated. Welcome to Big Mouth, and it's a very sad week this week. We were preparing the show when news came through about Keith Flint from The Prodigy. It is so far away from what The Prodigy were all about that it is very hard to compute, and it's very saddening. I'm Andrew Harrison, and I've got some of our regulars here with me. Sean Pattenden, as ever. Also, film journalist Linda Marrick, and all-round internet person Michael Moran. Hello, everybody.
How do you do?
Hello.
Hi.
It's poor Keith. It is just so sad and grim and just awful, isn't it? Sean, did you have an interview?
I didn't know, sadly, but I've heard nothing but good things about him.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you guys ever ran into him. He was just, like, the most lovely and fun person, and so very different from the guy running around screaming his lungs out of the video. And, in fact, since he died, one or two tales have emerged of people who were at side stage while The Prodigy were performing, and you see Keith running around like this insane dervish, spitting fire and all the rest of it. And then there'll be an instrumental, and Keith will just wander over to the edge of the stage and just stand next to him and go, "You all right, mate? What have you been up to lately, then?" "Oh, I've been working on my bikes. How about you?" "All right, I'm on now." "Twisted Instigator!" You know, just like flip it on and flip it off. Linda, you're a raver by confession, aren't you?
Yeah. No, I loved it. I loved him and I loved them. And I just think, I mean, just seeing the reaction from people who knew him or people who just met him once, how there wasn't a single person who said he wasn't just the nicest, most extraordinary person they've ever met. So, yeah, very sad.
What do you think made him special? Because there wasn't, I mean, it's not like it's a crowded field of dance goblin mixtures of, you know, Vivian from The Young Ones and Johnny Rotten. You know, he was a self-created weird individual. Why did that connect with people, do you think?
I think because he had a look, and at that time, not many like our pop stars or even rock stars had anything interesting going for them. And I think people really, you know.
That's true. It was it was an imageless scene.
Exactly.
It was very faceless. I mean, I don't want to say anything bad about anonymous bald men with glasses at all, but there were an awful lot of anonymous bald men with glasses prodding at laptops and whatnot, and it was not a particularly visual scene.
Yeah.
And then Keith was, and actually and Liam was as well, they were just good pop stars. Mm. I sold them a synthesizer once.
Tell you I had in my shop once.
Yeah,
right,
really,
the back of my cab.
Totally. And they turned up, and it would have been, you know, before lunchtime, and they were pop stars. They dressed like they had this colossal aura around them of, "Hi, we're showbiz," and it glowed out of them.
I mean, it's funny though, because actually there were quite a lot of, you know, anonymous bald men who had their own dance troupe.
Yeah,
who'd come and throw shapes, and you know, there'd be Podium Girl, and there'd be some dude doing running on the spot or whatever. But The Prodigy seemed to be above that, and I think it was probably the twist that, and it comes around Firestarter, where Keith decides that they're going to go a bit goth metal. Glam, evil demon. And again, reading around it after his death, I mean, I always thought that things like Firestarter and Breathe were just kind of this kind of insane nonsense that he came out with. But it transpires that it was a lot of that stuff really was about himself, you know, that he did have this turmoil in his head, had a really rough background, violent dad, expelled from school. And then it all comes splurging out in this kind of one-off, you know, character. You know, one thing that, you know, the reaction to Keith's death has been huge. And the fact that it was on the front of the Sun, I think, says a lot. Because, you know, it's like the fans of The Prodigy were, you know, they're not sort of, you know, PhD rock chin strokers.
No.
It's like fitters from Chelmsford and girls who like to party and just like ordinary people.
Yeah.
It was like hit really hard by this.
But you sometimes forget how massive they were. And that sort of brought it out as they were that dance act to make it into pop mainstream.
They were the
pop stars to come out of it, as we're saying.
And I don't forget how massive they were. I always remember how massive they were.
I think he's the first big loss for the Generation X, isn't he? He's the first person that we've lost from that generation.
It definitely is. And also, pop, you know, unlike, you know, obviously there's Kurt Cobain and things like that, and there's Amy Winehouse, but that was a clear trajectory of substance abuse and self-destruction, where you kind of, you're watching and you can kind of, when Kurt Cobain killed himself, I was simultaneously surprised and not remotely surprised.
Not surprised at all, yeah.
But with Keith, it's like, it is an issue of depression.
Yeah.
It was an issue. And then The Sun did this in their kind of report on it. Your standard issue, Wild Man of Rock finally goes too far. Wasn't that at all. I mean, he had a private life where, and the stories that are coming out are just heartbreaking. Like, he was really into his horses. There's pictures come out of, like, somebody said, you know, "Keith used to ride with me. He was a lovely bloke. Here's a picture of him on the horse. I thought, tack my bitch up, that's brilliant. You know, what he was really into his bikes. He was a normal, normal bloke. Yeah. We all heard the story about his pub with the swear jar.
Yes.
Yeah, whenever he stokes the coals and somebody says, you're a fire starter, they have to put a quid in. But I saw another brilliant one on Twitter, which is somebody saying when they were a kid, a couple of years after Firestarter had come out, it was exam day. And the woman stands up at the front and says, I'm the invigilator. And behind him, another kid goes, Punky and Instigator. and the room could not sustain kind of equilibrium after that.
There was even a nice James Blunt thing on Twitter. Did you see?
That was lovely, yeah.
Which is really lovely. Whereas Noel Gallagher had been rude about him. Everyone had been rude
about him. It's the Cure Wars, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And everybody's blanking Blunty, yeah.
And saying things to the press about Blunty as well at the time, and he can hear them. And Keith Finnick comes up and goes, how are you? Well done, mate. You know, well done on your success. And it's lovely. And I just thought, oh,
but there's
God.
There's a story about Brian May as well. Brian May said, yeah, we were on a festival with the Prodigy, probably the Isle of Wight or something. And he said, I was really frightened by these guys because they seem to be the real deal. And you know, I was terrified of them, particularly the Firestarter chap. He's really, really frightening. And then we passed in the corridor and I thought he was going to punch me. And he kind of got down on his knees and did the Wayne's World We Are Not Worthy and said to Brian May how much Queen had meant to him. It's just, you know, it's really, really sad and really heartbreaking. Yeah. You know, I think it's revealed. It's a little tiny good thing. Two good things. Mm-hmm. One, this is obviously an issue of depression and mental health and mental equilibrium. And people are talking about that now who would not necessarily previously have talked. Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. The other good thing is it just proves that, you know, that period of music and that world isn't just a little passing thing. And we can, you know, the standard narrative of it's really about Neil Young and the Beach Boys, isn't it? No, this means music. This music means things to millions, millions of people.
Absolutely.
R.I.P. Keith. Anyway, Sean, what have we got on the show?
We all need a bit of cheering up after that, which is lucky, because this week we have both cutting-edge comedy and high-quality popcorn movies. Oh, and a bit of euphoric disco too. Fleabag is back. What does Series 2 of The Worst-Behaved Woman in Britain have to tell us about modern life and whether it is or it is not rubbish? Marvel superhero movies finally have a female lead, but is Captain Marvel up to snuff? I'm the only one who hasn't seen it. Didn't get the invite, Andrew.
We only had three tickets, Sean.
Oh, right. But at least we have one non-nerd here in the shape of Linda. And for no good reason other than it's out in a new 40th anniversary edition, Number One in Heaven by Sparks. Possibly our favourite Giorgio Moroder spectacular, with lyrics about death, the inevitable acceleration of modern life, alienation and dehumanisation, all your favourites. We'll get into them after this reminder from Andrew.
If you want to join the Gilded Elite who get Big Mouth a day early, then there's an easy way to do it. Start backing us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon, and we will send you every show on the Friday, or maybe even the Thursday if we can, so you can fit it into your busy weekend schedule and lord it over your mates. We're asking for the equivalent of a pint of beer each month, which Sean insists is £5, so God knows where she goes drinking. At least, hem, hem, yes. Pledge us that amount, and we will send you the show a day early, plus the vaunted extra bit of additional big mouthery. This week, because the world is turning increasingly rotten, we're talking about our go-to cheer-up records, and Linda and Michael are going to stay and explain theirs, as well as me and Sean. Search Big Mouth Patreon to find out how to sign up. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
She's back. Phoebe Waller-Bridge made epic femino waves with the first series of Fleabag 2 years ago, which she both wrote and starred in on BBC Three. All risque jokes, lots of sex, 25 quid sandwiches and breaking the fourth wall, man. Now, Fleabag is back, also featuring Olivia Colman, Andrew Scott and others. Can Phoebe WB, as I call her, surpass the first series? Here's the trailer.
You know that feeling when a hot misogynist is turning up at your house for the second time in 48 hours? Just do something to get your head out of the fact that the only person you want to see in the world is the priest that you...
Don't sleep with him.
I don't do that anymore.
What? Why, you will?
So why do you think your father suggested you come for counselling?
Because I spent most of my adult life using sex to deflect from the screaming void inside my empty heart. I'm good at this.
It's all right, you look horrendous.
Why would you believe in something awful when you can believe in something wonderful?
Phoebe Waller-Bridge's Fleabag there. No relation to Hammersmith Bridge. Linda, would you set this up for us? This is series two and much anticipated.
Yes, so after the sort of the finale of the first series where we find out the big secret behind why she was feeling so self-destructive and depressed, we are reconnected with Fleabag, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, which, at a family dinner where her dad and who is married to a character played by Olivia Colman. They're getting married, and they're in this really posh restaurant, mm-hmm. and things start to unravel, basically.
And it's mainly the restaurant scene in this, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It's mostly, yeah.
Are you a fan of Fleabag, Linda? Were you pleased about this?
I am a massive fan of Fleabag. I'm a massive fan of hers. I like her writing. I think she also created the series Killing Eve.
Mm-hmm. She adapted it,
well,
yes.
And adapted it from a book. Absolutely love her. Love Fleabag. I think she's one of the few people who are writing really decent comedy, not dramedy, really, at the moment. And I really love her. I love the stories. I think there's like they really punch you hard. Mm-hmm. There's lots of comedy in it, but it's also very sort of, you know, depressing. Really.
Much is made of the fact that she is an unlikable character. Do you agree? And does this come out in this series? Is this series very much different from the last one?
I think she's very likable in this series. I think we are, because we know her so well from the last series, and because we get to really understand why she is like that. On the second season, we almost like you start to sort of completely put yourself in her place and understand what she's all about. I don't think she's unsympathetic. I think she's very sympathetic. Right. In fact, I really like her. I like her character. Yeah.
Michael, this show starts with bloodied noses, and we know that something's happened, but we don't know what it is yet. What did you think?
Well, I've cheated. And I've watched quite a few episodes now.
Oh, okay. You are allowed, but no spoilers, please.
I shan't. And it's a non-stop joy. And the way that weaves together, straight out slapstick at times, with that kind of comedy of embarrassment that was, you know, that we've had from Ricky Gervais and people like that. But they're all braided together with a bit of drama so seamlessly. And it flips between them without, you don't ever feel a gear change. So in this case, there is a colossal ruck that ends the main character end up with a bloody nose, and you mm-hmm. find out during the course of the episode that one or two other people might have bloody noses as well. And that is the actual event is a slapstick moment, but leading up to it is this terrific character comedy moment, and it's actually quite profoundly affecting because the relationship between her and her sister is paramount in this episode, and in fact, it's paramount in this series.
Yeah, it's not a spoiler to say that at the end of the last series, the sister's husband basically tries it on sexually on Fleabag, is rebuffed and then blames it on Fleabag.
Yeah.
And the sister believes that Fleabag tried it on with her husband.
Yeah.
And we are introduced, you know, we keep finding new layers of the nightmare that is this family, particularly the titanically awful Olivia Colman, godmother, who they all hate because she's steamed in to replace their late mother. But she manages to sort of wrap absolute cruelty and foulness in a big cheery smile, doesn't she?
Andrew, what do you think? You've obviously watched the whole of the first series.
I watched the whole of the first season, loved it, hoovered it up, thought it was fantastic. I thought it was I thought it took that kind of comedy, the comedy of embarrassment, several steps further. And I was absolutely, you know, delighted by this first episode of the new series. It is essentially, it's a stage play. It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare in a restaurant with nightmare people who, unfortunately, you happen to be related to. There are no spoilers here, but the intense wound upness of the sister, the alcoholic brother-in-law who is clearly an absolute wrong, and the pathetically weak dad, played by Bill
Patterson.
Can we finish a sentence?
Yeah. Can we also talk about Andrew Scott?
Andrew Scott, the priest. Yes.
Oh my God.
Please, go on.
He's just fantastic.
the sweary priest.
He's almost her male version of her, because he's also damaged.
He's very dysfunctional.
Yeah, he's very damaged. You know, his family are all alcoholics, apparently.
And there's another revealer too about the priest there. And Michael, you're not allowed to spoil this, but I thought that, you know, the telegraphing with Fleabag's brilliant side eyes, Phoebe Waller-Bridge's ability to not break the fourth wall, just like literally pull it down at 1 millimetre, peer through it and put it back up again.
Yeah, she welcomes you through the fourth wall.
She certainly does. And
there's one too many bits of that.
Oh, I'm happy with it. I love it. It is the show for me. Yeah. I think she telegraphs what's going to go on with her and the priest very, very, very well indeed. Mm. And I was completely bowled over by it. I do think she's a hugely sympathetic character hugely charismatic. I think this is a person who has been you know, fucked over by her awful family and also her own series of bad decisions. But a series of bad decisions should not necessarily be a sentence for a ruined life.
Yeah.
And I think she is the anti-hero of this. Mm. And I'm pulling for her enormously. I think she is one of the great modern television creations.
Absolutely. Definitely.
See, I have a problem with Fleabag.
What's your problem with Fleabag, Sean?
I watched the first one of the first series and actually couldn't get through the first programme of the first series. I hated her.
Why do you hate her?
I think it's an interesting question, Andrew. I found it so self-involved. I hate the breaking of the fourth wall because, as someone did say, Miranda for hipsters. There's something about that self-involved, I have to do this, I have to do this. There's almost excuse to be doing this. Look to camera, look to camera. Oh, just take it away and be honest and brave within what you're doing. I find her very self-conscious. I don't like the constant flagging of what a bad person she is, but I didn't get to the end. Obviously, there is a series, there's a story arc that I missed. So I did come in watching this, didn't hate it as much, but I still am one of those people who has a bit of a problem with Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
I think the finale of the first season will
would that
justify,
make it make sense?
Absolutely.
Could you even go back and see that last one and then watch this?
Yeah, it will completely and utterly justify why she acts that way.
Right.
I think you will get
I mean, the arc of season one is why is this awful person so awful? And by the end of it, you realise she's fully justified in behaving the way that she does.
It's essentially the question throughout the whole first series is, what is wrong with you?
Right.
And it's answered in the last episode.
Yeah.
And it's a kicker, it's like, really.
And now we're uncovering a whole new range of things that are wrong.
And I've got to say, the immense good fortune of, I mean, you know, brilliantly well put together, fantastically cast, but the immense good fortune of having Olivia Colman in this, I think, is going to do huge favours.
Well,
now she's the queen of the universe.
Yes, but the massive Andrew Scott fan, I would have to say. There's amazing lines in it, so I really did like some of the dialogue. The thing when Olivia Colman asks Andrew Scott about the priest who's just left the parish, they've realised he's died. What did he die of? And Andrew Scott just says, just time. That's wonderful. And when her sister asks Fleabag, you look well, where have you been? And she goes, boots. I mean, that's, you know, lines like that then lifted it for me from this posh woman has a bit of a crisis thing,
It is a terrific cast. And it gets better. I'm not going to name names, but there are other A-listers coming up.
Okay.
And not in a kind of big popping out of the screen clunk way, but in a just people quietly doing their jobs spectacularly well way.
I want to just like take issue as well with the criticism that puts out there that, you know, it's just a posh woman having a hard time. A hard time is not diminished by the fact that the person is posh.
Absolutely.
You know, she's the purgatory that she's in and the awful people who surround her and the good people who are too weak to do anything about the awfulness. You know, that doesn't change whether you're loaded or poor as a church mouse.
One of my issues is she knows she's awful, whereas some characters in dramas don't know the damage they're inflicting on the other people, and it's that self-consciousness that stops me a little bit.
But I think you discover in the first series she knows she's awful and she knows why she's awful, but this is, you know, this is her punk rock. Because the people around her reveal their far, far worse unknowing awfulness.
Oh, okay. So
and by the end of it, you're like, go on, Fleabag, do it again.
Yeah.
So Monday night is now comedy night, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We've got Alan Partridge, Kung Kong Britain, and then we've got Fleabag. Do you think the BBC are going, we've thought of something
it's now, the advent
we're
going
to stick with this?
It's Mitzi TV. It's the advent of, it's staying on Monday night. We're all out on Monday night, aren't we? You're tearing it up in fantastically expensive restaurants. No, I think it's a very good place to put comedy. Never understood why they put good comedy on Thursday and Friday when normal humans are out drinking.
Yeah. I could never understand that either.
Channel 4 completely gave up on their Friday night comedy.
Yes, that used to be a thing,
about 10
it?
Years ago.
Well,
which is a bit sad.
There is a major issue about people giving up on comedy in general.
In general,
For a few flagships, but particularly, you know, mainstream like ITV doesn't really have any comedy at all anymore.
A director once told her she had the gift of rage. That annoyed me as well.
What, rage annoys you?
No, she owned rage. I want a bit of that rage. I don't want her to have the gift of rage. I want us all to have it.
She's making it really big in America right now. They love her. Not just as an actress, but as a writer, as a creator of comedic content.
She was the best thing about that Star Wars. Yeah. She was a robot in Han Solo.
Yeah,
well, that's a film I did not care for, and I resent her being in it.
I did. A friend of mine was saying he will resent to his dying day the fact that she's not the female Doctor Who.
I wrote that. I was going to say that.
So that's another friend of mine who thinks that as well. Yeah, she should be the female Doctor Who.
She should have been a female Doctor Who. Sorry.
Because she's weird and she's unsettling and she's strange, unlike the current incumbent who isn't weird. Yeah.
So before Fleabag, do you think that this representation of femininity was sorely missed? Do you think we needed her?
Absolutely, yes, yes. Well, I mean, it's representation of humanity, really. I mean, I tend to not believe in any of the female comedy characters I'm offered usually. Mm. Yeah, then none of them, because they're often written by other men, and they don't really get how to write women, how to write funny women. I think that's the difference. Yeah, definitely, I agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I love the fact that the Martin Clunes show that's really awful is between all these amazing comedy things. You have to get through Martin Clunes to get to.
I believe they call that hammocking.
Oh, that sounds rude.
Put something ship between two good things.
Also, on iPlayer, could just go and watch Fleabag.
That's true. All right, so everyone else is going to watch this to the end of the series.
Absolutely. Yes.
And you're setting me my homework to watch it to the end.
Watch the first season.
First season.
Yeah.
You'll love it. Your mind will blow. Mm.
You'll fall in love with her.
You absolutely will. All right, let's move on and have some music chosen by one of our guests. Michael Moran, I believe you've gone for the new track from show favourites, Judah, the bothering, bother rock.
I
Italian.
Sort of have, yes. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I don't think this is a desperately good song.
Yeah, all right.
But it is a bloody good record. Mm. It sounds beautiful. I mean, without, you know, I don't want to be too inside baseball, but the engineer deserves a massive cream cake.
Right.
It is the sound of this record is how rock and roll bands should sound, in my view.
Good and crunchy and noisy.
It's noisy, but not so compressed as to be like that Oasis sort of smoothie of a record. You can hear bits sticking out of it. It's like a mace. It clobbers you around the head, not like a hammer, but with pointy bits.
Fantastic. All right, well, pucker up. This is Judah with Overdrive, and they're playing at the 100 Club in May. So if you want to come along and see me being a super yob, then come on down and we'll have a pint. Let's have a listen to Overdrive by Judah. Let everybody know. Now, Captain Marvel. He used to be a white bloke, then she was a black woman, and now she's a white woman, and the angry nerds don't like it. The campaign to sabotage this movie by angry neckbeards, because only boys can fly and have powers, right? That's just like science, was so sustained that Rotten Tomatoes had to close its I Want to See This function because they were all slagging it off and saying it was going to be a failure. Wrongly. It is literally an empowering movie, haha. But what about not angry nerds like me and Michael? Captain Marvel is touted as Earth's mightiest hero, but Brie Larson's debut turn as the all-flying, all-zapping cosmic hero has subtext aplenty. Female power, the feminisation of comics fandom, and the transformation of the movies into an adjunct of genre fiction. Oh, and it's set in 1995 with a soundtrack which aims to do for 90s pop what Guardians of the Galaxy did for 70s rock. To get you in the mood, here's a track from the soundtrack. British tunes are thin on the ground here. Well, here's one. It's Connection by Elastica. Now, Linda, you're by no means a comics geek, but you are a fan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Set this one up for us. Set up Captain Marvel. What's happening here? Why is it happening?
So, basically, we meet Carol Danvers, who's Captain Marvel, but we don't know yet.
She's a mystery lady
who's an amnesiac, and she's been looked after by this alien race, and she's like been trained to be this kind of elite fighter. When she's out at a battle, and she gets captured by a race of shape-shifting aliens who try to infiltrate her brain and get some information from her. She manages to escape because she's powerful, the most powerful elite fighter you could find. She manages to escape, and she follows them on Earth, where she meets Agent Fury and Coulson.
And she begins to discover that her past...
It's more
complicated than she thought, yeah. And that
she's connected to this female scientist somehow.
Yeah,
but she doesn't yet know.
And
she,
the alien races, Michael and I will know. She's with the Kree, with the K, mm-hmm. and the evil Skrulls. Who first appeared in Fantastic Four number 2 or something. They've got old school, aren't they? The Skrulls.
They're very silver.
Very age. Very old school. In this sort of massive space war, and she is somehow. Found herself part of it, even though she appears to be a human being. As someone who's not steeped in the lore of the comics, but is steeped in the lore of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, did you enjoy it? Do you think it was a good one?
I don't know much about the folklore of Marvel at all, but I really love these films. I think seen every single one of them right now, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I think some people have had been a bit down on it for some reason, but I love her. I think she's fantastic. I think she's fun. She's likable, and she really is the part. She's the part. You know, she is Captain Marvel. I love the story. The only thing I think she was a little bit overstaged by Samuel L. Jackson who plays Agent Fury. I think I needed to see her. Just on her own, on her sort of adventure on her own for a bit. And I think she was always with someone who was funnier than her.
But she's always the dominant character and the dominant partner in those exchanges, isn't she? I mean, Fury, who doesn't yet really get what's going on in the world of super stuff. He doesn't even believe in aliens yet. Yeah. This is his kind of moment when he realises it's a big universe out there. And she kind of, to her, it's like, this is a little backwater planet full of little backwater people like you. She kind of runs rings around it, which I really enjoyed. Because we're used to him being the guy that knows everything, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah. Although, this is by far his... longest time on screen.
Yeah.
It's his biggest role within that franchise.
It is essentially a two-hander between Brie Larson and Samuel L. Jackson, isn't it? And it's as much a Nick Fury origin story as it is a Captain Marvel.
Absolutely,
Marvel kind of
thing. We learn things about Nick.
We learn things about Nick that we've always wanted to know.
Yeah, and I love the film. I just wish they had trusted her to just sort of have her own time on her own to get on with doing things rather than sort of... You know,
there's a criticism of movies like this that we tend to go quest setback, massive space battle that a Marvel superhero movie is often on rails, and in some respects it did conform to that template. Do you think it did enough interesting things with that?
Absolutely, yes, definitely. It definitely did enough interesting things. It was funny. I think I absolutely loved the fact that they set it in the. Can I spoil this?
Oh, this is not a spoiler. This is a selling point. It's in the 90s.
I love that it's set in the mid 90s, and I love the music that comes with it. You know, so we've got Hole, Elastica, Nirvana, REM, I think as well. Your favourite. I think the sort of the device of setting it in the 90s creates also lots of humour about sort of. Pre-digital internet and things like that.
Yeah, there's sort of slow-loading DVDs.
Yeah, really love that.
Although I don't think they laid it on too thick. I think there's a couple of gags in there, but it's not that 70s show in space.
Yeah.
Personally, I wish that she'd crash-landed on a blockbuster in Skelmersdale, because then we could have had The Prodigy, Chemical Club Brothers, we could have had, you know, Saint Etienne, proper 90s music. Yeah. So it's established that the non-nerds like it. That's good. Michael, you're a nerd. Did you like it?
I liked it. I thought it was very much, you know, the thing we're asked to focus on here is that it's a female lead. Now, I didn't really focus on the facts of it, but I just felt like it was a good story told within that framework. I think I like Marvel movies. I accept they're all the same. With a couple of exceptions, Guardians of the Galaxy is a bit offbeat and Black Panther's a bit offbeat, but the rest of them...
Yeah, Thor Ragnarok's really offbeat, and Civil War was quite offbeat,
Winter Soldier's quite offbeat.
They're not all the same, Michael.
They're
all totally different, Michael.
I would disagree with you. I think that there is a formula that they've learned is effective, and this conforms to it fairly well. There are things within that formula I enjoyed enormously. There's a little twist about, I don't know, two-thirds of the way through that makes it particularly interesting for old-school nerds like what I am?
Well, actually, if it's the twist you're thinking about, I think that goes far beyond old-school nerds because we learn something about the nature of the space war and the nature of this character, this world of characters that makes us think differently about not just the tale we're being told, but the kind of movie that we're watching.
Yes.
And the moral framework of the movie that we're watching. I hope that's vague enough, but it's really...
It's a great moment.
It's really... Also, by the way... Very good makeup acting by Ben Mendelsohn as a Skrull. Mendelsohn is behind half a pound. Sean's glazing and going miles away here because she hasn't seen the film. But he's behind half a pound of wax and God knows what, and a pair of outside spotters.
But he acts
through it in Australian.
Yeah.
Apparently the Skrulls are Australian.
That's Bloody Hill, mate, yes.
Did Stan and Jack have invented them as Australians? Really, I don't know.
Also, let's not forget the cat. You know, there's an awesome cat in this film.
There's an awesome cat, a cat with a... there's an awesome cat in
there. There's an awesome cat, we can't say anymore.
No, can't say anymore.
The de-aging is particularly good on Samuel L. Jackson. That's remarkable, the kind of digital makeup that's applied to him on every frame.
Yeah.
I thought it was less convincing on Coulson. I felt like I was wondering whether it's because he's a less significant character, whether it's just less render time applied to him. But I had a touch of the Uncanny Valleys, a touch of the Princess Leia's with him that I did not have with Samuel L. Jackson.
Mm. I don't know. I'm not sure I agree because I'm a big fan of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
And I really bought that he was a younger Coulson.
Yeah.
So, I've seen him on screen more often than you have. If you don't watch, do you watch S.H.I.E.L.D.?
I watched about the first three series, and I ran out of time to watch it.
Yeah. On the woman power, modern feminism, it's been very much marketed on that background. The slogan is it begins with her and then a hero kind of thing. Absolutely hammering the, and I thought it worked perfectly well with exception of one scene, which is a little bit too on the nose, where a difficult thing is being attempted and the soundtrack goes into Just a Girl by No Doubt. And look, I get this. I understand where you go with this and you don't really need to ladle it on. But the preceding female-led superhero movie, Wonder Woman, I also thought was great, but Diana in Wonder Woman is literally a god. Mm. She is a goddess.
She's not a human.
An Amazon, whereas Carol Danvers is a human being.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a bit more kind of resonant.
Well, I think it's... I mean, as Captain Marvel, as a character, I think is a touch overpowered. She's kind of the Superman of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
And I think that becomes a bit bothersome in storytelling terms. Not so much in this film, but I anticipate that it will become bothersome in future films because she is just so indefatigable.
Well, she's very good at blowing stuff up and sort of flying through space at incredible speeds. But I think we're encountering problems that can't be solved by blowing them up. I think that is the issue with, physical might is not enough. And the end of the Avengers saga is coming up and we're going to see how that's going to get solved. It's not going to be solved by blowing somebody up.
It's going to be solved by guile.
It's going to be solved by guile.
But
now, interestingly, coming up soon in the next two or three weeks is the other Captain Marvel movie, Shazam, and DC's Captain Marvel, who changed their name. I think that, look, from the trailer that we've seen, and the gist of it is a young boy who's a teenage kid, a teenage weakling, in true pulpy naff comic style, gets a magic word which transforms him not just into a superhero but into a full grown adult superhero. And the humour in this trailer looks absolutely fantastic. Linda, are you enticed by it?
I am really looking forward to this, and it's not by Disney. This is from Warner Brothers, who are usually the DC people. So,
it's a DC Universe character, and I've got the impression I'm getting is that they may have finally nailed the charm and the humour that makes the Marvel movies work.
I've heard really good things from people who work in the industry who've already seen it. So let's see. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be great.
A subject close to the heart of plucky young newsboy Mickey Moran. Who has his own magic word.
Yes, I do, rather. I am anxious about this film. I think it feels to me like they might have suicide squatted me. They might have done a terrific trailer that, when you actually get to it, is at best a hammock full of shit.
A hammock full of shit? Two hammocks in one show?
Yeah.
I've got a warm feeling about it. I'm going to give it a go.
Okay, I'm going to give it a go because I am shameless and I watch superhero movies come what may. Yeah. And I haven't seen a bad one since Venom.
That was last week. Okay, so basically, we all like Captain Marvel. Okay, Sean, you can wake up now. You're back in the room. You'll inevitably have to go and see this.
One last thing about Captain Marvel is her relationship with her best mate, for me, is the highlight of the film.
Yeah.
I loved that relationship. I believed it. I think the acting for both of them is absolutely on point. And it, to me, it's the making of the movie, not all the running around and the flying and the punching things.
And we haven't even mentioned Jude Law. No. Who is great as a significant character who we should not say much more about.
Who I once beat to the last Monster High doll in the shop in Hamleys.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you kind of had a close shave there because you may well have been transported to be part of the Kree military if you'd fallen out with him.
Can I say one last thing about Captain Marvel? There's a scene, you can cut this if you want, there's a particular scene that reminded me so much about the last episode of Buffy, the finale Buffy, you know, with the little girls standing up.
I've never seen Buffy.
Oh, okay. I actually went back to see if Joss Whedon had written that bit because it was literally lifted out of it. I must remember to send you the clip of that.
Well, don't I have to watch the entire 7 series run of Buffy before it makes sense?
I'll just send you the clip of Buffy.
Yeah. Fair dues.
Okay, let's get back to Earth with another tune from our guest, Linda Marrick. What have you brought in for us and why?
I brought in a cover by Françoise Hardy, cover of Leonard Cohen's Suzanne in French. And I am a massive Françoise Hardy fan, and I really like... She has done a few covers, actually. She's also covered Serge Gainsbourg many times. She's done albums in English as well. I absolutely love this song. I mean, if you love Suzanne, you love this song, but she gives it sort of a bit more gravitas as well. She gives it a bit more sort of gentle sort of Frenchness, you know, to it. And I really love this song.
Wonderful. Let's have a listen. Suzanne t'emmène écouter les sirènes. Elle te prend par la main pour passer une nuit sans fin. Tu sais qu'elle est à moitié folle. C'est pourquoi tu veux rester sur un plateau d'argent. Elle te sert du thé au jasmin. Et quand tu voudrais lui dire, tu n'as pas de mots. Depuis toujours tu l'aimes. Tu veux rester à ses côtés. Maintenant tu n'as plus peur de voyager. Les yeux fermés, une flamme brûle dans ton cœur. Il était un pêcheur venu sur la terre. Finally,
we need a bit of disco euphoria after the week we've had. Luckily, number one in heaven, Sparks' album with Giorgio Moroder and their most commercially successful release is out again in a giant 40th anniversary edition. Recorded in Germany in 1978 as Sparks' comeback, because the success of This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us had not been repeated, it wrong-footed everyone with its pure electronics and cosmic worldview. And even though there's only 6 tracks on it, number one in heaven produced 3 hit singles, including this, Beat the Clock. Bit of male supremacy there. Michael Moran, were you familiar with Number One in Heaven back in the day?
To me, it was a one-off single kind of thing. I'd forgotten about Sparks. I was obviously aware of them in the glam era, and I'd forgotten about them the way that we do because there's so much good music coming down the pike. Last week's pop band is gone. Then this came along, and I loved it. And at the time, I was not really particularly conscious of how extraordinarily influential it was. Now I look back and think... Everything I listen to for about 2 or 3 years following this record comes from this record.
Yeah.
Comes from, Giorgio Moroder's work and actually Keith Forsey, who made the good Billy Idol records.
Oh, right.
Which I love with a rare passion. Everything about the early 80s, that first half of the 80s, which is kind of my wheelhouse, comes from this record. And I hadn't noticed until this week.
It is essentially where I Feel Love. It's where sequencing, it's where collides with... art and the mad worldview of the Mayall Brothers. I mean, I ran down this to double check. There is not a love song on this record. Yeah. No. The first track is written from the point of view of a sperm. Triumphs for the human race. We just want to be someone. Literally, they want to be someone. There's number one song in Heaven, which is a ridiculously transcendent song. Beat the Clock, the story of someone accelerating their life so that you know, by the age of 4 or 5, they're an old man. And this is not an allegory or a parallel or a satire. It's actually about that
they're
subject.
About these things.
Yeah. My Other Voice, which appears to be a reference to The Shout, you know, the movie The Shout, the man whose voice can literally... So it's informed by all this mad stuff, and it is a big art disco happening.
It's a banger.
It was a real...
You couldn't have had I Travel without this record, for example.
Yeah. And it was a real thing for me when it came out, because I was about 11, 12 or something like that, and suddenly these records that don't make sense are structured in a way that you don't expect, arriving in these astonishingly sexy, peculiar covers. And the cover of it is quite famous. It pictures a kind of a I don't know whether she's supposed to be an afterlife nurse or some kind of reimagined post-punk angel doing the Marilyn Monroe sort of draft up the skirt thing, but it's caused by static electricity rather than... And it's like, it's techno and it's futuristic, it's cold and it's sexy and it's weird, and that was basically me for life. Yeah. Sean, did you like it? Are you familiar with this record?
Not very familiar. I know Kimono My House more, oddly, and thought, oh, I must have heard this many, many times, but went back to it and thought, no, this is quite new to me. But the sound is obviously the future. The sound is incredible. Mm. The production is amazing, and there's so many layers and all those production techniques, as Michael is saying, then that you've heard on other records. Lots of reversing, lots of tracked vocals. And when you think this is before auto-tune and the tracked vocals and what Giorgio Moroder is doing with that and the male voice then sounding like a choir, it is incredible. It is the future. It is space. It is so... Also, as you're saying, these short stories that are within the songs, it's like listening to a novel. It is incredible, but a novel just goes ping, 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 you know, kapow. It sounds fantastic, and I was listening to it just now because I wanted to hear it again and again and again.
There's also a particular track on the Academy Award performance, which you can't say the word without doing the tune. Academy Award performance. Yeah. And it's like, I mean, they are total cineasts, and they subsequently made a record about Ingmar Bergman. But it's like a Bergman movie. It's like the prison of a woman in the prison of her talent.
Yes.
With people coming up and going, do Mrs. Hyde, do that baby that you didn't want. Yeah. Do Queen, do Lady Macbeth, do the Queen.
Drowned by compliments, isn't it?
Drowned by compliments, but also the tone and the freneticism of the tune, mirroring the turmoil behind this perfect face and this I just think it's absolutely incredible. That's just that one track. To me, also, the structuring of these tunes is and I remember hearing them at the time and being totally bamboozled at the age of 12 or whatever. Yeah. You can't make a record like this.
Yeah.
The radio hits that I'd heard would be preceded by 4 minutes of overture.
Absolutely, because I hadn't remembered that Number One in Heaven is so long.
It's an epic.
And the first half is just an incredible piece of music, as it is anyway, and that you could listen without even getting to the bit where, you know...
Edit.
Yeah, the single edit where it's hitting over the head with all the hooks.
Yeah.
It's... To hear that kind of conception of how music should be, and then they followed through with that.
And it's a very European record.
Yes. It's very craftwork.
You kind of forget that they're Americans. They don't sound like Americans. It's a very European sensibility. And the preceding 10 years was kind of, you know, owned by America. I mean, like, sure, we had Zeppelin, for example, but they were very Americana in their way.
Yeah.
And even Bowie was pretty European by this stage.
But also, let's not forget that for most people, they thought that Sparks was this weird band who seemed to have Hitler playing keyboards.
Yeah.
And you don't get much more European than that, do you? I mean, even John Lennon famously thought it was Hitler. My dad certainly thought it was Hitler when they were on Top of the Pops. The Toothbrush Moustache. Linda, what did you make of the show? Are you familiar with it?
I'm not familiar with this album in particular. I'm just like Sean, I'm more familiar with Kimono My House and sort of the rest of the stuff that came afterwards, and I've seen them in concert twice, I think, once at Morrissey's Meltdown once with Franz Ferdinand a few years ago.
Yeah, the FSS show.
Yes. Which is a great album.
Which is an absolutely brilliant album, not familiar with this at all, but completely get why so many people have been influenced by it. Because it's like the birth of techno, in my opinion.
And the invention of the synth duo as well.
The synth and the repetitive, I like anything with a repetitive beat for me is, I'm in already. So I was so impressed by it. And Why haven't I never heard of it before? So, yeah.
A criticism of Sparks that's often advanced is that this kind of writing is just too arch. Where are the love songs? Why are you writing a song about what it's like to be an actress, or what it's like to be a sperm, or what it's like to be a person whose life lasts 5 years? And the phrase "too clever by half" pops up, which makes me think, well, would you like it to be more stupid? How stupid would you like things to be?
The expression "too clever by half" is one of those things that really annoys me. Nothing's clever enough for me. And I'm happy for it to be arch, and because there are plenty of other people writing love songs. If you want love songs, I can show you a bin full of them right now.
Yeah,
but there's not that much mad stuff about sperm, so let's have it.
There's very few records about from the point of view of sperm. As a kid, I remember watching Top of the Pops throughout the 70s. Well, possibly, you never know. Throughout the 70s, I remember watching Top of the Pops every week and thinking, why are all the songs about love? Why are they about love? Admittedly, I'm 9 years old at the time, so it's not a huge topic for me. But it still continued to baffle me. Like, there are other things to write about. I think this is why Park Life was such a huge success, because it was about other things.
Yeah.
Other things you could think about. Well, this to me is pretty much my perfect record. It is just, you can dance to it. It sounds sonically bizarre. It sounds like it was made yesterday, listened to it. And actually, then subsequently investigating Spark, I knew this sounded big enough for both of us because it had been a hit, so you knew the hit.
Of course.
And then I was sort of slightly disappointed because they made all the guitar records. One of all the records. And then they never made one like this again.
But they've done it. What I like, though, is it's got live drums on it.
Yeah.
And the drum sound is amazing. So it's not totally like they've thrown everything else in the bin and just gone with the synth thing. They really are trying to experiment with fusing.
Yeah.
And their camp, the falsetto is everywhere. There's something that's so not masculine as well. So we do music, and we're not going to do the rock myth anymore, which I just absolutely love.
Yeah. Well, I
really warm to.
I had a life-changing experience with Sparks this morning.
Oh, what happened?
Because I'm a top international journalist, I was on a plane. I was coming back from a job in a foreign country, and the plane was coming in about 7 o'clock in the morning, and I was listening to Number One in Heaven again. And as the title track, the final track, Number One in Heaven, which begins with 4 minutes of kind of overture, as Russell sort of introduces the concept that there is a song playing in the afterlife. We're just above the clouds, and the sun is low because it's just risen.
Yeah.
And all these beautiful pillowy synths are around me, and I'm looking through the porthole, and I feel like I'm in the song. And the lyrics, the lines, why are you hearing it now? Maybe you're closer to him than you think, than you imagine. Maybe you're closer to him than you want to be.
Yeah, are you dead?
Yeah, are you dead? Have you died? Why are you hearing the Number One song in heaven?
That happened to me down Lexington Street just a minute ago.
There you go. And then the brilliant break in the middle where the overture just fades away, and the Syndrome's classic, boop, boop.
Oh, yeah, Syndrome's.
And we go straight into Number One song in heaven.
Yeah.
Was when the plane came out from beneath the clouds, and there's
it
London
was made
before
for
me.
You.
It was the most astonishing experience. I think I will remember it for the rest of my life. Like the most, the perfect song at the perfect moment. And I thought, I love this record still. And I actually love it even a bit more now, because that was just unrepeatable. So there you go. Listeners, if you've had spiritual experiences while listening to Disco Records, please get in touch.
Yeah.
And there's a free...
They've also got a record called Listen Up Morrissey. Can I just say that?
Lighten Up Morrissey. Lighten Up Morrissey.
It's autocorrect. Lighten Up Morrissey that they did in later years.
I think they're on a fool's
errand
of that
video,
one.
Yeah. The video of that was awesome.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're coming to the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our panel be discussing over a 12-quid cup of tea as Fleabag attempts to chuck us out of her cafe from Series 1? Linda?
I want to talk about the new series by Ricky Gervais, which I surprisingly liked very, very much.
It's Afterlife, Number One in Heaven.
Yeah, it's a theme.
It's a series he's done for Netflix, so I think it's, six-part series. I've seen all of it now, and I really liked it. It's about this... It's a story of depression, loss, grief, and loads of the old Ricky Gervais sort of awkward comedy thrown in. I mean, it doesn't get everything completely right. I mean, to set the story up is Tony, Ricky Gervais, has lost his wife, Lisa, of cancer. She's the love of his life, and she's died. She's recently died, and she's left him a video message, basically giving him instructions of how to live his life. But he's completely given up on life. He doesn't want to be alive. The only thing that's keeping him alive is his dog, the reason why he doesn't want to kill himself is because he doesn't want to leave his dog behind. And it's, I think it's just really touching, and it's not something people have said about Ricky Gervais in recent years, really. I mean, there's a lot of reactionary humour from him lately, and I think those people just don't know where to put him anymore. He's still kind of like a left-wing comedian, but people don't get where he wants to take his comedy, and I think those people misunderstand where he's coming from, and I think this will probably warm people to him again.
How Brent is he in this? Because I think for a lot of people, it's not Brent at all.
Not Brent at
for
all.
For a lot of people, he's sort of
the
sort of slight tragedy of Ricky Gervais is that you watch The Office and you think that what a brilliant character he's created, and then as years go by, you realise that actually he didn't really create the character. There's like a lot of him in that character.
He is not Brent at all. He's basically Ricky. It's him. He's funny, acerbic, nihilistic to the point of sort of not wanting, you know, doesn't really care what happens to him. I think that's what I liked about it. I think I was getting really fed up with sort of this kind of him playing the sort of the Brent, you know, repeatedly. Yeah. I really liked it.
Does it look big budget? Because he was on the radio talking about having a much bigger budget through Netflix. Is it glossy?
To me, it doesn't look any more glossy than his BBC stuff.
There's no peacocks.
So I have no idea. I have, you know.
Crowds.
There are. Ashley Jensen is back as well in it, and she's fantastic. And Roisin Conaty, really brilliant cast, really fantastic cast.
Great. Michael, closing time chatter.
I am hot from the new Dior exhibition at the Albert Museum.
I've seen posters from
Now, I am not fashion people. Look at me. I'm a scruff. However...
Actually, you're looking quite smart in that
suit. He's very dapper,
Michael
actually.
Moran.
Listeners, viewers.
Yeah, he's lying. Yeah.
Step in razor.
It is an absolute delight. It is a ravishing exhibition. And you don't have to be frock people to get it. It's... The first room, I thought, this is amazing. This room. And, you know, there's like... The first thing you see is a classic new look outfit. And you think... Well, this is it. This is what I came to see. So really, they can take the rest of the day off, as far as I'm concerned. It's a thing of beauty. And you kind of think, I understand why clothes have to evolve and change. But for me, if we're just stuck here, that would have been cool. Mm-hmm. And in the next room, you think, oh, no, this is my new favourite room now. Mm. I love this. What's very clever about it is the way it's arranged thematically, not through the ages. Obviously, you know, Dior died, and then his legacy passed on through different designers, some of whom are quite well known, some of you don't really remember. But his legacy does endure. When you see like an outfit from 1958 and then one from 2018 right next to each other, and you can see that there are echoes from one to the other, and that there is this line, which you wouldn't necessarily, you know, for somebody like me who really only cares about old aeroplanes and comic books, I don't think that hard about fashion. And to see how this thematic line endures within a house over decades is interesting and illuminating. Mm-hmm. Plus, they're lovely frocks. Plus, there's all sorts of mad stuff. There's a room with a whole wall of fashion magazines pinned to the wall that you could just sit and look at for a while. For some reason, there is a bottle of Dior-branded fake blood. I don't know why that's there.
Like that.
That's not explained.
Yeah. For the goths, then.
Yeah. I think... And, you know, I mean, some of the... Like, so, for example, you know Galliano worked there as their lead designer for years. So his clothes kind of honk out of the line a bit for me.
Right.
He's a bit, look at me, mum. But
well, that's Galliano.
But that's just him, you know. And God bless him, he's got a little moustache, so what are you going to do? But everything else
more
is just...
There, yes.
You somehow see the whole line as a thing through time, and it's a delight.
Do they have the £700 I'm a feminist T-shirt, which I could probably knock up myself for a fiver?
They do not. No, I've actually bought my daughter just yesterday one that says equal rights and pizza, and they didn't have that.
Wonderful. Andrew?
I want to talk about Liam Fox's £107,000 podcast.
Oh, yes.
Liam Bloody Fox.
Oh, yes. He's got a big wallet.
Liam Fox... disgraced former Defence Secretary Liam Fox, his department commissioned a podcast to big up British exports. They produced 6 episodes for £107,000, and on the 6 episodes, they got 8,300 listeners. You've probably got more now from people listening to it just to marvel at
curiosity.
Nick Hewer from Off the Apprentice is in it.
Yes. I wonder out of Countdown.
From Now Out of Countdown. Apparently, I don't think it's a wild guess to imagine that the lion's share of the 107 of your taxpayers' money, Sean, went to Nick Hewer.
Yeah, I'm not that happy about
that. And I just looked at that and I thought, they saw you coming, didn't they? I also thought, I'm not saying we get more listeners on Big Mouth than this.
But we do.
But we do by a huge factor. We've got more listeners than Liam Bloody Fox.
Yeah.
Well, so we should have.
Do you think that Liam Fox is the biggest ass clown in the current cabinet?
Well, it's a tough one because Grayling.
Grayling. Yeah.
Davis?
Davis is he's not in the cabinet. He's smart enough to not be in the cabinet.
Not anymore, no. But on the rare occasions he wakes up, he can, like, do some funny stuff.
Chris Grayling wouldn't even find a job, be given a job, if he just walked into an office. He is that terrible
everything. There's a guy who wasted 33 million quid on ferries that don't exist.
Yeah.
Clownery. That's cabinet ass clownery. So that's another factor. But I just thought, because it's quite close to home. So listen, disgraced Defence Secretary Liam Fox, if you're listening, and if you need a podcast for £107,000,
yeah, we'll do it.
We'll make it. We'll make it to Netflix special standard and perform it probably live at, at Earth in Hackney, or possibly the Bull and Gate, if you like.
And we'll get more
listeners. And we'll get more bloody listeners.
Will it be
than
a video podcast, though? So that so one of us can say cinema verity.
Absolutely, we could do that. I actually think for £107,000, we could perform it live on the back of a truck, like the Bureau on the day-to-day.
Yeah.
Up down the country.
I'm closing it for an hour.
Sean.
We haven't talked about BritBox, so my closing time chatter is BritBox, which unfortunately rhymes with S-Box.
What's BritBox, Sean?
Oh, you know what BritBox is, Andrew. It's the BBC and ITV finally doing a version of Netflix to sell their stuff around the world, which I thought they sold anyway.
Netflix.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just doomed from the beginning, isn't it? It's called BritBox for a start.
Well, launch a thing called BritBox at a time when Britain is basically throwing its own feces around the world.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. Do you not think that, we'll make the Brit bit really good? We've got Brexit, but there's the Brit bit. We'll do the Brit bit. That's great. We'll sell Brit. And we could call ourselves Brit, not Britain anymore. I mean, we could really roll with this. It's just diabolical. Who was in the meeting room where they all put their hands up?
Ass
clowns. That's a good name.
I'm sure that a large part of the meeting went, can we call it Britflix? Or should it be hours and hours?
Netflix.
Lots and lots of flip charts.
What's it? PPT.
PowerPoint.
Yeah, PPT PowerPoint. Files. Have you got the PPT files? Yeah. No, they don't work. All that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They were so bored by the end of that. How
many streaming services will the average person sign up for? When you've got Netflix, you've got the Disney one, got
they
Hulu.
Amazon.
Yeah, it just becomes exasperating.
I think two maximums.
I've got an idea.
Oh, yeah. Go on.
Television, instead of doing it through different streaming services that you have to put through, we should have a network of satellites over the earth that beam them down to your house, all from the same place.
Yeah.
Or maybe we could put metal shapes on top of your house that would connect to a broad... I'm calling it a broadcast.
I like where
broad
you're going with this, and but is there any cocaine involved?
None required.
Bad meeting.
You could put the... The transmitter could be somewhere high up, like Winter Hill.
This is incredible.
Or
this
Crystal
is,
Palace. Or Alexander
you are cooking
Palace.
The gas, Andrew.
Any palace, really.
Let me tell you about my idea to print the new internet on paper and sell it in the shop where you get your fags.
People actually buy it.
A tremendous idea that I think should be implemented, which is that we should print the internet, or in fact, the news part of it, in little fax machines that print out toilet roll
at the same
with
time.
The news on. So you're sitting there, it's because the only place you're sitting undisturbed now, and it prints out the news while you're sitting there.
That's a great
idea.
It's
okay, I've got my iPhone for that, sorry.
In my house, I have a VHS copy of The Man Who Fell to Earth, and I look at that sometimes and I think, we're going to be reduced to this. I'm just going to have my copy left and streaming.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to exist. Somehow the world will explode and I will be left clutching that VHS copy of The
Man Who Fell to Earth.
The Earth dies streaming.
You'll
fall through the roof of a Blockbuster.
Yeah.
That will be the one video that you land on.
There we go.
Yes.
So Britbox shitbox, says Sean. Right, that's the end of Big Mouth for this week. Linda and Michael are going to stick around for the extra bit for Patreon backers in a minute, in which we're going to talk about our go-to cheer-up albums. But in the meantime, thank you, Linda, for coming. Thank you, Michael, joining us for this epic moaning session. Thanks to Sean and to producer Alex Reese as well. We're going to be back next week, and we're going to play out with a bit more Keith Flint and the Prodigy from their most recent album, No Tourists. This is with Keith on vocals, Champions of London, with Keith's vocal recorded in a crappy hotel room in Belgium after a particularly high-energy gig, apparently. Liam Howlett insisted on booking into one-star crap hotels to maintain the vibe on the tour. This contains the lines, civil unrest, grab the bulletproof vest. We'll see you next week, and Godspeed you, Keith Flint, Champion of London.